you.
Okay, this is going to be a little bit like what you saw this morning about soil heat flux, but much less complicated. It's already been pointed out that heat flux plates can misestimate surface G, both because of thermal conductivity mismatches at the depth they're installed, depth Z, mismatches between the thermal conductivity of the plate itself and that of the surrounding soil, and lack of bulk density and water content data for the calculation of the volumetric heat capacity in the layer above the heat flux plate for the correction to the surface. And then the fact that the surface corrections themselves involve measurements in the soil, typically, of temperature alone. So often you don't have water content, but the measurements are still taking place in the soil, so you're not really correcting all the way to the surface. For that reason, a number of folks think that soil heat flux, as typically measured, is underestimated for surface energy balance estimates of latent energy using things like eddy covariance, where you get some data about other fluxes, and then you're using the net radiation and the soil heat flux to close the energy balance. And quite a few folks are now beginning to question whether we're getting large enough soil heat flux values with traditional methods. So what this is a science series solution that we apply. We fit a science series to the diel variation at depth Z0, and that can be at the surface or it can be subsurface. And then we find best fit diffusivity in the layer below that by using the heat flux science series solution and finding the best fit diffusivity for that layer. Then we take the volumetric heat capacity in that layer, which we estimate because we measured the water content in it, and we find the thermal conductivity. And then in the end, we take all what we think are the good values of thermal conductivity that come out of this process, and we find a function of thermal conductivity with water content. And this is the missing link. We've known for a long time that we can measure temperature at the surface, sometimes well if we know how to do that right, and at some subsurface depth, preferably fairly shallow, and solve the heat flux equation directly. It's a finite difference, essentially, solution, but we can do that. It can be fairly accurate if we know what the thermal conductivity of the soil is. Well, before we had water content measurements that were easy and automated and accurate, we could not estimate the thermal conductivity from a K theta function well at all, and so people typically didn't do that. So I'm going to show you how we've done it. The measurements we did were between two rows of cotton that were in the north-south direction. So to the right is north. We had five locations equally spaced apart. The ones closest to the row were 7.5 centimeters from the row, and then 15 centimeter spacings between those locations. And the heat flux plates are right here. Here's number one, two, going over here to five, and then there's the TER probes right next to them. We didn't put the TER probes right over the heat flux plates, but we got awfully close. We had 10 heat flux plates, 30 TDR probes, and 70 thermocouples. Looking at the side of the pit that we put these in, you can see a TDR probe at 2 centimeters, and then further down at 6, and then down here at 12, and then a thermocouple at the surface, pinned to the surface. These thermocouples were coated with epoxy, and then dipped in dry soil and allowed to dry, so their albedo was pretty close to the surface albedo. I checked this in Marana, Arizona years ago and used infrared thermometer surface temperature measurements and found that this kind of thermocouple, if pinned to the soil surface with a non-conductive pin, gives you a very accurate surface temperature. And then above the heat flux plates, which were buried at 8 centimeters, we had then 2 and 6 centimeters, we had thermocouples. That's just how we installed them in the field. This was a row and bed cotton system, and you notice we leveled in this area so that we had a level surface to work off of and not working in beds. And we used a jig to get these things in at the right depth so that they're actually fairly close to 2 and 6 and 4 and whatever. The theory is pretty standard, Fourier heat flux theory. Notice that the thermal conductivity is outside the brackets. It's invariant, and the reason we can do this is that we solve this for every layer. And so we're assuming that the thermal conductivity in the layer at that time was essentially constant. It isn't constant with depth because of bulk density changes and water content changes, but at a particular time and depth, it's reasonably constant so that you can apply this solution. Here's a sine series that can be fit. It's a multiple step. I use 6 terms. You can use as few as 2 and get pretty reasonable results. And the upper boundary condition is shown here. It can be rewritten in this form. And then if you fit this sine series, you can back calculate alpha A and B here using these formula. So essentially, we fit the sine series, we get the coefficients, we get everything but the diffusivity, and then we use that equation to predict what the temperature should be at the next lower depth, and we get the best fit diffusivity. We did this in 3 periods during the season. As the cotton leaf area increased, cotton height increased and leaf area increased, we had a beginning, a middle, and an end set of measurements. And this is what soil temperature looked like early in the season. Here's your surface temperature measurements, the ones at 4 centimeters, 8 centimeters, 16 centimeters. You can see the phase, the lag here, phase differences. And you can see that near the surface, or at the surface, it gets quite noisy. Later in the season, with a leaf area index of 0.4, remember these are north-south rows, so we have a sun fleck, or a band of sunlit soil, that begins at the western side of the mid-row in the morning and travels across the mid-row, or inner row, during the day and ends up on the east side of the inner row in the afternoon, and then everything becomes completely shaded. And that's what you're seeing here. You're seeing here the surface temperature being increased according to the sun, and then the sun's moving off that area of soil, temperature's rapidly decreasing. Here's in the center, these darker symbols here over on the other side of the inner row. So the system gets kind of complex, and it becomes difficult then to, in this sort of a system, to fit these data. But we still got some successful results. But I'll show you later that this has implications for the heat flux. During an irrigation, of course, we have soil cooling due to the irrigation. We also have convective heat flux in the soil, and this theory that we're applying doesn't handle convective heat flux, and so we ignored all irrigation days. Here's a fit earlier in the season. This is the basis temperature, in this case at 0 centimeters, the surface. And here's the heat flux temperature as predicted. And you can see a slight phase difference here, but a pretty good fit and a pretty good value of thermal diffusivity for that layer. Here's one during an irrigation, not such a good fit. Here's one later. By the way, this dashed line is water content for the layer. And later in the season, the fit's good. The root mean squared error is fine. But because of this convective heat flux, the value of diffusivity is completely wrong. So you do have to screen data pretty well. But after screening a season's worth of data and throwing out a lot of things that had high root mean squared errors or were on irrigation days, had other problems, we used a series. I'm not going to describe the series of of screening tools we use, but I can give that to anybody who's interested. We ended up with this sort of a fit. This is bulk density in this direction. Bulk density did increase with depth in this soil. Water content in this direction, and this is our fit of thermal conductivity using McInnes's equation. So if Kevin's around, we used your equation, Kevin. It worked fairly well, but it did give us a negative thermal conductivity, and so we had to set a baseline for that when we predicted thermal conductivity. Here's soil heat flux sensed with heat flux plates at 8 centimeters in north-south rows on day 217 in the mid period, but towards the end of the mid period. And you can see that sun flux causing different timing of heat flux at different depths or at different positions along the inner row. Here is the surface soil heat flux calculated traditionally using the divergence here and measurements of soil temperature at 2 and 6 centimeters, using the water contents measured at those depths to get the volumetric heat capacity, and using the bulk density, by the way, at those depths to calculate volumetric heat capacity. And here is that calculated between 0 and 2 centimeter depths using a direct calculation, including the storage in that layer, and you see a couple of things. One, you see larger values, and two, you see broader peaks here to some extent, because this is actually capturing that surface temperature, and the heat flux doesn't stop until the sun moves off that spot, whereas when we're correcting the heat flux plate data, we get more of an integrated view of the heat flux. It's smooth. Here it is in the beginning period, and this is the heat flux average for all the days in the beginning period. And you're seeing, again, some differences in absolute values. You're seeing some differences here in some spikes due to what the actual surface soil temperature was. And here it is for the mid period. And then again, you see again some differences and a little bit more broadness here as the sun flux moved across particular areas. And if you think you see a phase difference, there's also a phase difference here. Using a direct calculation, you do get a little bit earlier heat flux values. If you were validating a model, or if you were trying to combine these heat flux plate data with eddy covariance data, this would solve some minor problem that you would have in the heat flux. Also notice that the values are pretty darn large, nearly 300 watts per meter squared for the direct calculation. About the same for the soil heat flux plate method in this case. But these are large values compared to a net radiation of, say, 900 watts per meter squared and a latent energy that might be on that order of magnitude. And this is late in the season at the end period, and you're only seeing now the middle areas in the row. Canopy cover is nearly complete, and you're only seeing the three middle areas and very, very short-lived sun flux moving across that. And again, this method pretty much replicates what we see with heat flux plates, but there are some differences. It returns to a zero heat flux, for instance, much more quickly, because the heat flux plate method is still measuring heat moving through 8 centimeters. And here we're seeing that there is actually no heat flux. So in conclusion, vertical arrays of water content and temperature sensors can be used to find a K-theta function. The same sensor arrays can be used to find soil heat flux between the surface and temperature sensor depths, or G between temperature sensor depths. which is important. We can calculate G at 8 centimeter depth if we want to, if we have temperature sensors above and below that depth and the correct thermal conductivity function. Spatial and temporal variation of soil heat flux was well documented using either method, but I think slightly better documented using the direct calculation method using the TDR and surface temperature measurements. And the sensor array measurement method does give water content and the K-theta relationship in addition to the soil heat flux. So it has some advantages. Not only are we not worried about the conductivity of the soil heat flux, contact issues with that flux plate with the soil, but we're gaining additional information. And now that we have sensors that, like the Acclima sensor and the CS655 from Campbell Scientific that measure water content well and temperature, we have the ability now to put in arrays horizontally of these sensors and get soil heat flux fairly well, I think as well as we can do with heat flux plates, and probably cheaper, and get the additional data that we often need.